Hello and welcome to Bizarre Conspiracies. My name is Eric, and with me today is
Conrad Toll. And today we will be talking about the coming collapse of society in the year 2040.
Hopefully the second time is the best time.
I assume that you're trying to make a reference to the second rebuilding of society would be better than the first.
The second recording.
I was kind of hoping that perhaps what we need is like a restart. So I may be getting ahead of myself here, but I don't necessarily think that a collapse of society is necessarily the worst thing in the world. There's been many times in history where there's been massive setbacks, but we've always rebuilt back better. But hey, that's probably something we should say for the closing of today's podcast. Right now, what I want to tell y'all about is that there was this group in the 1970s, a research group from Switzerland called MIT, and with the newly discovered computers at the time, they decided they were going to run a calculation of the future. They built this simulation of the world's economies and the resources and the inputs and all that sort of thing, and they ran several different scenarios to try and predict what the future would hold, and they found an alarming number of problems that started coming around in the year 2040. Later, I think it was just in 2010, research group decided to restudy these findings and found that we are ahead of schedule for a pending collapse. So I heard this and thought, well, you know what? That sounds like a topic because everybody needs a nice reminder, you know, the world's collapsing at any minute now. So, it's 4 or so years we hear something like this, Eric?
Yeah, sounds about right.
So I thought it would make for an interesting topic. So whether or not it actually happens, I was compelled by a few different things that I saw that maybe connect and verify findings. So I thought maybe I'll just bring that and you can decide for yourself. So what is it exactly in these studies that they found? There was three different outcomes that they were primarily finding.
Well, yeah, like you said, there are three scenarios, but I did not look at the scenarios. I looked at the highlighted MIT study. So they have this complex interactions between population, industrial output, food production, resources, I think even the pollination. So they want to consider all of these factors together. And the comprehensive technology scenario presented a more optimistic outlook, showing how technological innovation can present challenges and maintain living standards. So a big chunk of this was food production, right? The decline in food production.
That's not necessarily a terrible thing that if you have food production. The problem is that economists will kindly put it in a specific way. If you have a decline in population, which is followed by a decline in food production because population is not requiring food, that is entirely a different scenario than a food production shortage followed by a population reduction. Two very different things. But that's not necessarily what the MIT group was leaning more towards was the second scenario, where the food production issues was a resource problem, that eventually there would be a difficulty producing enough food to maintain the current population. And they found that at the end of year 2100, they predicted that the population would be equal to the 1900s. So in 100 years, it would be like we went back 100 years, essentially, in time, with production and output and population numbers and standard of living, quality of life, that sort of thing would just regress back in time. It'd be a big step backwards. Now, in some of the scenarios, they put in an idea, what if there was a massive breakthrough technology and they fiddled around because they didn't know what things were going to be in the 70s. And of course, we don't know what the future will hold currently now. So they were predicting, what if there was a massive breakthrough in technology called crop production in a way in which we cannot foresee now? And for instance, in the early 1900s, there was a breakthrough with fertilization where they found a way to produce better nitrogen fertilizer through chemistry. And that is what led to a massive economic and agricultural boom in the early 20s, around like the roaring 20s and whatnot. But we have not seen anything as significant as synthetic fertilizers that have come on the market as a result of massive technological breakthroughs. And what people have done recently is looked at this project and the research and seen where on the line of progression we fall now. Which scenarios have we been closely mirroring? And it hasn't been the technological breakthrough or the rapid change model where there was significant changes to economics and sustainable farming practices. Instead, they find that we closely follow more along to the lines of business as usual. In the business as usual, what they find is that due to a number of things, primarily pollution, exhausting of important minerals, and so with the decrease of minerals and with the increase in pollution and the deforestation, they found that there would be a resource shortage, essentially, of all types, which would hamper industry in the form of there's a lot of different resources that are required to make modern day electronics. The big ones that you hear about a lot is things like lithium and cobalt and the other things that are used to make batteries these days. But a lot of these resources are becoming more and more difficult to mine. So they found that the depletion of mineable resources becoming more and more expensive makes it harder to produce modern technological goods, things like computer chips and that sort of thing. And as well, that the deforestation and the loss of farming land and that sort of thing would cause a problem with crop production. Think of it as akin to the Chinese Great Leap Forward financial initiative. Have you heard of the Great Leap Forward, Eric?
No.
So at the beginning of the communist rule in China, they wanted to make China a industrial nation and transition away from farming. And they called this economic program the Great Leap Forward. And what it entailed was that they wanted people to go into making things like factories and engines and tools, tractors, those sort of things. They wanted to produce a lot of equipment. So the Great Leap Forward pushed for the creation of metal. And as a result, a lot of farmers stopped farming, cut down a lot of trees, and began smelting iron and trying to make it into steel. What happened was there was a massive amount of deforestation in China and a huge amounts of mud slides because with the dying of the roots and that sort of thing, wind and water erosion became so bad that it became hard for there to be any arable land. One of the few things that led to the mass starvation in early China, where I think something like 30 to 40 million people starved to death. I'm just trying to remember that number off the top of my head. I'm sure I'm actually lowballing it, but it was a terrible famine in the early communist China due to this loss of farmland. And that's essentially what was found in this MIT study, is that at some point, a lot of these loss of resources is going to eventually start a cascading effect where you're going to see a failure in crops. And then also in the industrial side, when the components that go into making lots of electronics start becoming exorbitantly expensive, as the easy to mine resources have all been depleted, and now more and metals are having to be sought in difficult mining conditions in spots that are not very rich. So a lot more mining has to be done for a significantly smaller yield, causing the price of a lot of these components just to skyrocket and causing a massive hit to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I have found a few different things that all seem to actually point towards, maybe it's just coincidental and maybe it's all just alarmist, but I did find a few things that seemed very similar. But here's the more frightening thing that I found is a lot of these problems are being exported to third world developing economies and is sacrificing a lot of, or staving off the effects. So it's not felt in the more developed countries for a while until things become critical in other parts of the world that we can't actually see. And when the third world countries and the developing economies start really feeling the strain, then it will spread and boomerang around the world and it'll all come crashing down at once. So you wouldn't say, Eric, that you've seen a significant amount of the depletion of farming land in the U.S., would you?
I don't know.
Well, I guess that's a little difficult for us because we're in the Texas Hill Country. But there is a spot not too far away from where we are where they sell lots of peaches and pecans.
Yes.
And they seem to be doing all right. So
I suppose, but I'm a bit of a hermit. So,
if the theory is correct, I think that you would want to see the collapse, well, not want to see, but you would be looking for strain factors in other countries. Because the U.S. is a developed economy, there are a large number of environmental regulations that are supposed to keep back things like pollutants and littering and other types of things that damage the environment. However, those aren't present in a lot of third world countries. So if you were to see agricultural collapse in other parts of the world where things are not as well kept as developed country, how would that affect the U.S.? Wouldn't the U.S. just continue on just like it always been doing? If all these other countries are having difficulty, how could a collapse of a developing country strongly affect the U.S., right? You would think that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, have you ever heard of the concept of brain drain, Eric?
I don't believe I have.
So it is a theory in migration, essentially, and immigration. In a lot of countries, say, I'll use India as an example, but there's a lot of countries like India where this is the case. If you're a talented scholar and a very smart child, you go through the education there, you get a massive lead, you use the resources that are available to you, and then once you get to the point where it's time to start looking to go to college and that sort of thing, you have all these opportunities in front of you because you're the best and the brightest. So what is very popular in a lot of these countries is to get student visas to a developing country and go and study abroad and to become a doctor or an engineer or that sort of thing. Well, once a student becomes a doctor or an engineer, they don't move back to their home country because the best and the brightest, they can make 10, you know, maybe not that much, maybe 5 or 8 or 10 times as much in the U.S. or in Europe than they could in their home country, just because their skills are more lucrative in an advanced economy more than that of a developing economy. Because of this, there is what they call the brain drain. All the smartest, the best, and the brightest, they grow up, their home country, they use all the resources of their parenting country. When they're a child, they're not producing to the economy. They're essentially a drain of resources, an investment on the future, where the idea is you educate the children and that sort of feed them and you care for them and all these expenses. And the idea is they will more than pay for themselves once become an adult. But instead, what they do is they immigrate to a developing country and you get the worst of both worlds, essentially. Your best and brightest are leaving you after you've spent all this investment. And the developing country gets an educated, intelligent immigrant without having to have all the cost of rearing them. So that is the brain drain. And that is actually one of the things that is keeping a lot of companies in the modern world afloat. These developing countries, like the US and that sort of thing, I'm sure you've heard of the aging population, right?
Yeah.
The populations on average are getting older because we're having less and less children. And as the baby boomers start to retire, their cohort is the largest generation that we have. And all the successive generations have been smaller than them. And in order to keep the system going, the governments of the developed countries have been importing labor. These developing countries have been people who have the most, I guess, the more successful people who have the means to immigrate or are the most entrepreneurial, seeking, who are willing to take risks and are the ones who drive economy, the most productive workers, the smartest workers. These are the ones who are the most likely to leave their country in search of a better, more lucrative. So what you find is essentially, if developing countries were to stop or were to lose their source of immigration, they wouldn't be able to support the aging demographics. There would be the complete reversal of the growth, where all of a sudden you're spending all of your excess GDP on trying to maintain living for the retired communities, which are no longer contributing to the economy. So that is probably one of the bigger factors of what would happen if there was a collapse in the third world countries. And these developing economies are actually suffering significantly more than in the 90s and in the 2010s, because there are three main things which propel a developing economy into a fully developed economy. And that is investment, capital investment, the workforce, and natural resources. So a lot of these countries that have gone from being a developing economy to a developed economy typically will use a combination of all three. But sometimes they can get by with just two. But what you found is a lot of the ones that are going to become a developed economy have already done so. And the remaining ones are struggling because essentially success leads to more success, where failure also leads to more failure. A lot of these countries that haven't developed are war-torn and have a high amount of corruption. There's a lot of pollution and dictatorships and instability. And what that means is there's more lucrative places to invest in. And what happens is all of the developed economies do not go and install more investments into them. And the economies remain stagnant. And a lot of the countries with the high corruption and that sort of thing tend to turn into dictatorships. And the dictatorships will then use the natural resources as their own personal piggy bank and not reinvest the economic wealth that comes out of exporting these resources into furthering the standard of living for their country. And because there's so much corruption and war and instability, more and more young people who are able to make a good living in a developed country are moving away, further exacerbating the problem. So what you find is it's becoming harder and harder for a country to go from developing to developed. It's harder to make that leap. And as more and more modern economies are running into a population decline, they're making it more and more lucrative for immigration, which essentially just feeds more into the problem of the developed economies not developing. So the problem then leads to it's not sustainable. The birth rates in a lot of these developing countries are dropping. Used to in Ethiopia, which had the highest birth rate in Africa, was 10 point something. And it's now dropped over the last 20 years down to just 4.
Wow, that is low.
Yeah. And it's not the only one. It's spread across all of Africa, South America, Southern Asia. In China, obviously, it's been well known there, and in the Far East and that sort of the Orient and whatnot. There is gone even worse. And some places in, I think it's South Korea, has one of the worst birth rates. It's something like 1.2 or something like that. And China used to have a huge birth rate. I don't know if you knew that. We think of now that like the one child policy and how China has a very low population rate, but it used to be huge. It used to be something like 10 as well. But that's how China got to be something like 2.1 billion population. It wasn't through a low birth rate. So birth rates are dropping all across the world, and it's becoming more and more unstable in these developing countries. And the problem is self-circulating. And a lot of these developing countries are unable to fix the problem because they can't create new natural resources. Once they're gone, they're gone. A lot of the governments are unable or unwilling to make any changes. It's very rare for a dictator to go, you know what, we should think about the future. That's not in any dictator's wheelhouse.
Yeah, probably not.
So what you'll find is all at once, there's going to be a ceasing of cheap resources from these developing countries. And there's going to be a stop in the immigration. There's going to be less skilled workers, and the cream of the cream are going to stop immigrating just because there's just so few people, and the economies will get worse in the developing countries that it will become hard even to immigrate, even if they wanted to. And there's many places in Africa where the dictators are actually now trying to curb immigration. Places like Eritrea have actually banned immigration because they saw something like 1/6 of their population has immigrated.
Wow.
But you don't really see that sort of thing on the developed side of the world. We see lots of people coming into countries. I know that immigration is a big political topic, and so we're always talking about the influx, but we're not seeing the other side. We're not seeing the reservoirs essentially going empty. The human capital is diminishing.
Conrad, do you remember, this might have been a year or two ago when we did an episode similar to this. It was by the year 2030, there would be a massive food shortage.
Not particularly. Why did we say, I'm going to need more specifics to go off of?
Oh, well, there was just a prediction similar to MIT that the Western world would run out of food by 2030. And so I'm wondering, of all these predictions, right, of...
are all happening, are all seeing the same thing, but are all independent of one another?
Yes, but because that was 2030, and 2030 is not too far away. 2040 is not too far away either.
Well, actually, when they redid the studies in 2010, they found that we were actually ahead of schedule.
Right.
It would bring it around to the 2030 mark.
Scary. Like you were saying, there's low birth rates all over the world. What's causing all these low birth rates?
Well, it has to do with the fact that children have gone from being a financial benefit to a financial burden. As economies become developed,
we're talking children about the Western world, right?
School. No, all around the world.
This is all around the world.
Yes, even in places that you would think, well, that's not very developed. Even in places where there's still mostly agriculture in, children are more of a burden than a financial investment. Because used to, if you had 8 children, you would expect 4 of them would make it to adulthood. And at the age of 8, they could start working on the farm, and they could probably start helping with lots of other chores long before 8. I don't know exactly when a child would start to produce financially, but they would do manual labor, things that have been replaced with machines now.
Right.
And even in developing economies, they still have access to electricity.
Right.
It may not be for all hours of the day, but they still have access to electricity and labor-saving devices, which makes child labor not only redundant, but actually inefficient compared to all the other options that are available.
Right. So, but wouldn't using equipment be more of a financial burden?
No. A tractor is cheaper than a child.
In a undeveloped country?
Yes. What? And they actually repair a lot of these machines. A lot of these tractors that are used in agriculture in Africa have been there for 20 or more years. And when they break down, they just repair them. I'm sure you've heard of the Toyota Hilux, right?
Yes.
Hilux?
Yeah.
It's a very popular car in Africa because it's so easy to repair and there's so many parts for them. The parts and labor and that sort of thing is actually cheap enough that it is cheaper to own a vehicle than it is to own, say, a travel animal. And also vehicles are much more
reliable.
Fast. Not necessarily reliable, but they're reliable enough. Well, so even in a developing economy, there is a big mark that the developed economies in close proximity to them make on them. Just because they're a developing economy doesn't mean that they're working with hand tools and animals. They have machines and they have...
Well, surely a child has more value than just work, right? There's got to be another reason why the birth rate is so low.
No, not really. It really does boil down to economy. I've heard there's a few other things.
Well, I mean, you're definitely
with, like,
right.
Education.
Right.
That they say that as, especially when you have education for the youth, like elementary school and that sort of thing, even just rudimentary education where most children in developing economies learn to read, a more educated population leads to a lower birth rate and also a lower marriage rate. More educated women have fewer children. Now, exactly why that is, I'm not sure.
Ah, well, maybe I can give you some insight. So I recently watched a Japanese documentary. I think I was actually telling you about this.
I think you were.
Yeah. So in Japan, they interviewed a lot of, you know, the older people there. Like, not old, but like 40, 50, somewhere around there. And a lot of them have said that the younger generation don't want children because they are uncertain about their future. They're worried about money. They believe that they can't afford it, right? To have a child and mm-hmm. all the responsibilities that go with it. And they even interviewed the couples that did have children. And they interviewed this one woman who had two kids who was living with her, not husband, but the father of the children. They all lived together, family of four. But they're not together, the parents, but they live together for a better financial stability in the household income.
Uh-huh.
But they said even people who have children like they do, it's very rare. And I thought that was the most insane thing I've ever heard.
Yes, it is kind of a weird world where children are seen as a financial liability. I do think that it is, a good portion of it is fear of the future, but I don't think that's necessarily all of it, because in the Middle Ages, people were always terrified of what the future may hold, but they still had tons of children.
Well, yeah, but they didn't have anything else to do back then.
But in the modern world, a lot of people, before they have kids, they want to have a lot of things lined up financially so they can support the children, right? They think, well, you know, if we have a child, there might be something that goes wrong and we might have a huge medical bill. So we want to make sure that we have money set aside. We want to own a house. We want to make sure that we have a few months of incomes saved up. We want to make sure that we can afford all of the extra bills and that sort of thing. And you start looking at things responsibly like that. And what you find is a lot of people don't have kids simply due to the price. And also they don't know if they'd be good parents, I guess, is part of it.
Well, who is a good parent?
Yeah. And I think another thing that maybe would be different from the past is used to families didn't necessarily move out as far away from each other as they used to. And there was more of a family community. So the idea is if you had a child and you lived next door to your parents, if you can't raise the child or you don't know what to do, it's really helpful to go to your parent and say, what do I do when the kid says no, I don't want to do my homework, or no, I won't do my chores. Like, what do you do in this circumstance? You know, it's more of a relief to have backup like that on immediate call. Or can you watch the kid? I've got to go out and do X, Y, and Z.
I've got to go down to the bar.
Maybe. But you might want to come up with a better excuse for, I don't know, your mother-in-law or whatnot.
Well, here's the thing. I'm just trying to figure out the logic in not having kids, because wouldn't that just damage the world in general?
Well, I don't know, Eric. Why don't you have any kids?
Well, hey, I do want kids, actually. So I'm not saying I'm never going to have kids. It just hasn't happened yet.
I see. Yeah, I don't know. It never necessarily made sense to me either, but I'm not sure that I want kids. But I'm not. Yeah, that I'm a whole other mess.
Well, anyway. Okay, kids aside, we're still running out of food, right? That's one of the big problems.
I don't know if it's necessarily food that's going to be the problem for the U.S. The problem for the U.S., I believe, will be, what are we going to do when there's too many people retired and not enough people in the working force?
Ah, yes, the working force. Well, aren't we at an all-time low for unemployment?
I don't know, but that's not necessarily a sign that we have a good working force. The size of the working force is not necessarily... because I think unemployment is actually considered part of the working force. They're the unemployed section. And there, I make that distinction because there's a lot of people in that I've heard, I think it was in like 2018, that they were said there was a lot of people who were leaving the working force. And that is why the unemployment rate was dropping. Not because people were finding jobs. They were just giving up trying to find a job and just retiring. So it was an exodus from the workforce. Implying that the unemployed people are still technically part of the workforce. It just is a balance, the ratio of how many people in the workforce are finding meaningful employment, or not necessarily meaningful, but finding a degree of meaningful employment.
Right.
Because I'm pretty sure that I think it's like 40 or more percent of the current employed workforce said that they wish they had a different job. So
don't we all say that at one point?
Yes. I think that is a fact. So I think what you would see in the U.S., and I've seen it happened just recently in France. In France, they had a problem with Macron wanted to raise the age for which you became eligible for the federal pension, the government pension service.
And there was a bunch of
riots. I think it went up by almost 5 years. It was a big jump, and there was lots of protesting, and there was burning things in the street, and I think Macron actually had to eventually back down.
Everybody, but the same thing happened.
Yeah, and the same thing happened in Russia not too long ago. Before Russia invaded Ukraine, Putin wanted to raise the age for a retirement, and Putin has a dictator's approval rating. What a dictator's approval rating is, nobody says that they disapprove of the dictator unless the dictator is highly unpopular. But because if somebody's Because here's the thing. If you're in Russia, right, and a government official comes up to you and says, do you approve of the president? And the president's a dictator, right? How unhappy do you have to be to say, I don't like the president, right? You have to be pretty, pretty pissed off.
Do you, though?
You do. And another thing that really helps is if everybody, like, you're standing in a line, right? And you hear the guy in front of you say, oh, I don't like him. And the guy in front of him said that he didn't like him. Like, all these people are all saying that they don't like him. Then it doesn't feel like, you know, all that dangerous to go out on a limb and say, yes, I don't like him as well. You feel there's safety in numbers. So, well, that's what I mean by a approval rating of a dictator. When Putin tried to make that increase in the retirement age, his approval numbers dropped to the point where they met, where his approval rating and his unapproval rating met. So he was at not a, he wasn't negative, but he wasn't really positive in his approval rating. And he backed off of that and his numbers went back up. It's really been the only other time that that really happened was when he announced the draft. But when it became obvious that the draft was only of the poor regions and the rich regions like St. Petersburg and Moscow were going to be mostly on undrafted, his approval rating went back up. And that's a common thing for dictatorships. But the most surprising thing about these dips is his approval rating rides around 90%. That's very high, right? But it's deceptive. It's really not at 90. That's just what people feel like they have to say, except for when they're really pissed off. Anyway, the main point is when you try to raise that Russia tried to raise and France tried to raise the retirement age because they are suffering the problems of an aging demographic and that things are becoming more and more difficult for a lot of these developed economies to keep going. More and more companies are going under.
Right.
Inflation seems to be, well, wages aren't growing to keep up with inflation. So essentially, people are making less today on average than they were making 5 years ago, which is not necessarily the case. You still get pay raises, which increase as you go on. So you still make more at the end of your work career. But maybe the better way of saying this would be somebody with 5 years of experience today makes less money than somebody in the same position would have made with 5 years of experience 5 years prior. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So per parity, money is wages are dropping, companies are failing, things are becoming tighter, but there's all these different things in place where the economy is very resilient, where it keeps itself afloat and it adjusts and things become harder, but we just tighten our belts a little bit and we adjust to the circumstances and we don't let the little things break us. We just, you know, take the slightly heavier burden and we continue down the road until eventually the burden becomes so heavy that it breaks. And when the breaking point happens, it will happen in one spot before it happens anywhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some places got to break first, but that's going to put more stress on some other parts of the system, and those parts are going to break. And then it's going to turn into a cascade where everything just starts seeming to break all at once. I'll give you an example. China. So, just
yeah, but recently, there's a lot of things wrong with China at the moment, right?
Yes.
I mean, they got a debt crisis, they got deflation, they even have a property market collapse.
Right. But all of this is starting to hit all at once. But this problem didn't start overnight. This problem has been around forever. And China is just a hyper example of what's going on because Chinese economy is built around exponential growth. The developing world is built around continuous growth, not exponential, where it's like, yeah, every year we're going to grow by 3 or 4%, and that's going to be good. China is only going to grow by 3 or 4% this year. And that's seen as a disaster because the economy is geared and set up to grow exponentially. And when it's not growing at huge rates, it's going to start to fail. And so they are a more hyper version of what we've got. But they are considered a developed economy, but they may not be a developed economy for very long. They may regress into a developing economy. Only one country, I think, has ever been considered a developed economy and then regressed into a developed economy, a developing economy. And I think that's Brazil, but I might be wrong about that. There might be others, but it's very rare. But it's possible China might do that. Because if you've been paying attention to the Chinese economics sector, the real estate sector was built around the idea that they will have huge amounts of growth forever. So what they will do is the construction companies said they would build a house and then people would buy the house before it was built. The company would then take that money and then fund future projects with those that aren't going to be built yet. So essentially, and then they would hope that the people who would then, let me try and give these projects names so it's more clear. They start a housing project. We'll call this project housing. People pay for project housing before it's finished, before it's even started. The company takes the money from Project Housing, and they start Project Foreign Belt and Road Initiative Project. And they take the money that they're going to get from the Housing and Road Initiative, and they use that money to build Project Housing. And then when Project Housing is complete, they're going to then build Project Belt and Road Initiative by collecting money from another project elsewhere, which they haven't even started. So they're going to then pick a new project. We're going to call this project Project Singapore. And they're going to take the money from Project Singapore, and they're going to build the Belt and Road Initiative with that one. So they're collecting the money on something because the idea is they're growing so fast that the houses are so valuable that people are willing to pay a huge amount of money for them before they're even built. And they can take that money and put it in the bank and use it for other projects because there's so much growth, there's so much money, there's so much future in return that they can spend today's money on future projects. Well, then COVID happened, and a lot of their loans came due, and with their exponential growth all the time system, it came back to bite them because they didn't finish their projects, and they have the loans that they have to pay, they have all of these people that they're supposed to build houses for, and they don't have the money to even do the construction, let alone buy the materials for the construction. So they go bankrupt.
And I guess all the people who spent the money on these unbuilt homes didn't get their money back?
Nope. And to make problems worse, the banks, which loaned a lot of money into these, don't get their monies back either. So now the banking system is the next system that gets hit with all of these loans that they're not going to collect any of their money back on. Ooh. And these banks are selling off these loans to collection companies for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
Because they're essentially worthless. So they take all these massive hits, but everything in the Chinese economy is geared for exponential growth. So a lot of these banking companies are now having to be bailed out by the government. And there's still, it's not even clear if that's going to save these banks. If the banking system starts collapsing, then the local municipalities, which rely on the banks, are going to start collapsing. And the local municipalities are then going to need to be bailed out by the government. And if the government doesn't bail those out, it's going to be catastrophic. So that's what I think the snapshot of the future will be. Currently in China, right now, if you're a civilian, you cannot purchase foreign stocks. You can only buy Chinese stocks that are domestic. But what they've done to get around this is there are companies that own U.S. stocks. That's all these are. They're shell companies because the companies can own foreign stocks, but the private civilian cannot. So what a company does is they set up as a company. They issue their own stocks. They take the money from those stocks and they buy U.S. stocks. So it's like an exchange.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a roundabout way of accomplishing the same thing. These companies are collecting, people are buying these stocks at double the value than if the company was liquidated today. So if these foreign companies that are buying foreign stocks, right, were to sell all of their U.S. stocks, convert all that money into Chinese yuan, that money would only be half of all the money that the companies have invested, that the people have invested into them. They are being wildly overinvested because the people who are investing into these companies know what they're doing. But they're saying, if I invest into this company, at least I will get half of my dollars back. Because wow. They're expecting the yuan to crash. They're expecting that a half loss on their money is better than a all loss.
I suppose.
So that's what's going on. It's not looking good. The Chinese economy is in a point of possible complete despair and panic right now. Whether or not it will actually go to collapse, I am not sure. But I'm assuming that is what the collapse of the developing markets and economies would look like.
Jeez, what a grim outlook, huh?
Yes. So there is possibly a bright side.
Oh, sure.
we've We've never had a developed economy crash around the whole world. We've gone from a modern developed economy, stepped back to the 19th century, and then had to do it all over again. That's never happened. So maybe things will be better the second time.
Well, I suppose that will conclude today's episode.
Alrighty, well, thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.